but I think we should start. And it is wonderful to have you all here. And I'd like to welcome you to this online conversation. We are so excited to have so many people registered for this event, more than 100 participants from all around the world. And that is just fabulous. So I still think there will be more people coming in as we speak. And Whitney, my co-director of Counterpoint, will take care of those. My name is Coco von Stuckrad, and I'm one of the co-founders and co-directors of Counterpoint, Navigating Knowledge. Whitney Baumann and I started this initiative in 2018 to facilitate a real conversation between academics, artists, activists, journalists, and other producers of knowledge that we need to bring to the table for the benefit of the planetary community. And here we are on the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. Many regard the celebration of the first Earth Day 50 years ago in 1970 as the beginning of a new phase of the modern environmental movement. Joining other activities that mark this anniversary today, Counterpoint organizes this special event that looks back at recent developments in planetary thinking. We will focus on the idea that personhood does not only apply to the human species. And we will not only talk about personhood, but about related topics like agency, like epistemologies, like knowledge, like language, like ethics, and so on. And we will approach these topics from four different perspectives. And we have four panelists, which I will introduce later as they speak, or before they speak. On this panel on rethinking personhood beyond the human in this online event. I should say also that 22 April does not only mark Earth Day. Today is also Immanuel Kant's 296th birthday. He was born in 1724. What is more, today also marks the 75th anniversary of the liberation of 3,000 people from the concentration camp at Sachsenhausen by Polish and Russian soldiers, not far from Berlin, where I am and Whitney also is tonight. In one way or another, all of these events and anniversaries have to do with personhood and the question of how we see humanity as part of a planetary network. What we will do in this conversation today is to explore the permeable boundaries between humans, animals, and plants by looking theoretically, philosophically, and ethically at personhood. Some cultures argue that trees and other plants are persons. Just to give some examples, in New Zealand and in India, rivers have been legally designated as persons. In Australia, recently, a mountain important to the Aboriginals was given personhood. So the question we want to address is, how does this undoing of old notions of personhood reshape our religious, philosophical, and ethical traditions? So I look very much forward to having this conversation, this 2 hours that we have, more or less. And this is a good thing about having an online thing. We don't are a little bit more flexible. Maybe we need more time. Maybe we need less time, and so on. So, but I look very much forward to this conversation, and we will organize it in a way that we have these four panelists who will give 10 to 15 minutes short input to the discussion first. Then we have a short discussion among the panelists themselves, and then we open it up to questions from all around the world, basically, for all the others who join us, which by then might be like 100 people or so. So to organize this in a way that that is feasible and manageable, Whitney is in charge of the technology today. And correct me if I'm wrong, if I describe something wrongly, because you're more experienced in Zoom than I am. But we all of us are muted basically, and if you want to address a question or say something yourself, then you just use the chat function, and then Whitney can unmute you, and you can join the discussion. This is the most important information, I think, for now. You should also know that maybe you see this also in Zoom, that we are recording the session. So if you don't want that, then also let us know, or just keep out of the discussion if you don't want to be part of the recording. Have I forgotten anything, Whitney, or is this?
That sounds good. That sounds
good. Okay. So I will basically introduce the speakers for the first part, and then Whitney will take over the second part with the discussion and give the word to the people from all over the world, which is an exciting thing. And also looking at all the names, it's a who's who of the field. It's very it's overwhelming to have all this expertise in accumulated here in this group. But I'd like now to give the floor to our first speaker, and that is Teja Brooks Priebach. She has a PhD from Sydney University. And she is an independent scholar and multidisciplinary artist. Her book, which is based on her PhD thesis, it's called Enter the Animal, Cross-Species Perspectives on Grief and Spirituality, which will be out with Sydney University Press soon. And she will talk about a world of selves, human and other people. Please, Teja, the floor is yours, and I will mute my microphone.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I'd like to begin with a quote that I came across recently, and there are two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other one is as though everything is a miracle. I'm going to try to copy this into the chat, if we can. There you go. Now, it's attributed to Einstein. I don't know whether he said it or not, and it's a bit black and white, but I find it quite beautiful. So we are intrinsically relational creatures. We develop in relation. Relations shape us. They sustain us. But here we are, deeply relational at the core, but living predominantly among objects or objectified entities. Now, how does this affect us? Now, I don't propose to answer this in 10 minutes, but I'd like to talk a little bit about animal selves, about animal persons, how we develop, and then touch upon non-animal persons and our role in creating all of them. So humans and many other animals, certainly all mammals and birds, and most likely way beyond that, but we're still learning about it, we are critically dependent on the care we receive from others. It's not only about food and physical protection, but in the early period of life, our brain and our systems for biological and psychological regulation are still developing. That's another little chatting. Yeah. The primary caregiver, which is usually the mother, but not necessarily, acts as an external regulator for the baby animal's internal state, as a superstructure that directs our responses to things that are happening inside out. And through this, the caregiver influences the organization of our responses. It molds our patterns of response and regulation They will then stay with us for quite a while and perhaps forever. So a caregiver that is attuned to the infant and is able to successfully regulate this state, for example, soothe negative states and exacerbate positive happy ones, will teach the infant's organism that it is possible to tolerate and regulate negative effects. And in the long run, this will lead to adaptive physical and mental health. Whereas inadequate regulation in this early period can compromise the capacity for successful self-regulation later in life. It can also affect our immunological resilience and make us more prone to inflammation. So humans like to test these things in invasive experiments on non-human animals. And over again, these experiments show how important it is for animals to have a loving, caring, attuned presence in these early stages. So the infantile organism, and to various extents also the adult organism, is primed for this implicit communication, this relationality with agents, not all of whom are necessarily tangible, let alone human. The organism will recognize agents even if we don't. So the primary caregiver herself or himself could perhaps be better viewed as an agentive space rather than a singular entity, because of this multimodal support and communication that it offers to the infant. And in this space, in this communion of agencies, in relation with the agencies, two other things develop that will influence our life and the life of others. That is our sense of self and the brain's categorization system. Now, Daniel Siegel has a beautiful line in his book, Mindsight, which I will also copy into the chat. Here. We first know ourselves as reflected in the other. And indeed, the feedback we get from the environment, including the primary caregiver's responses, and this is valid for other animals, not just humans, will shape much of our sense of self, for better or for worse. And here we're talking about the self that feels itself, rather than the self that thinks itself and analyzes matters and, you know, writes philosophical essays and self-help books and stuff like that. So, depending on the developmental context and obviously other factors, the self will continue to live and feel more or less interdependent or independent with others on the self-non-self continuum. This feedback, this input, will also shape our categorization system and influence how we end up perceiving and constructing others, other selves, other persons, and whether we construct them as such in the first place. So here we have the categorization system. So the categorization system is an incredibly useful thing to have. It makes life easier because we don't have to stop and analyze every single stimulus we encounter. The brain will automatically categorize things according to templates that we develop based on experience and input generally. Until it encounters something novel that then we'll have to stop and evaluate it, find a category for it, and so on. And so the categorization system is a great energy saver, but there's also a problem with it. It is extremely vulnerable to exaggeration and to prejudice. For example, it enables us to see two completely comparable organisms, such as a dog and a pig, in a completely different light. One is friend, one is food. One we love, one we kill. Unless, of course, it's a stray dog or some other undesirable dog category. And this is in this culture. In some other culture, the dog is food, and some Europeans and Americans get all upset about it. But in the end, it's all about physically edible bodies being considered culturally edible or not. So invariably, entities, material entities, but also ideas, will fall into different categories. And these categories will have values and meanings attached to them, which will then determine our attitude and behavior towards them. And these patterns, as mentioned, are heavily influenced by our environment. Like, you can grow up in a place where a tree is a person and a non-human animal is a person, or mountains and rivers are persons, and that's considered totally normal in that environment. Or you can live in a place where even another human is not necessarily a person. And once these patterns get established, it takes a lot of undoing. And sometimes I think that it's really just sheer luck if you even get to a point where you realize that you are doing all these things without thinking, that actually knowing why you're doing them, why you're feeling that way, why you're reasoning that way. But when it happened to me, when I got to this point, it felt incredibly liberating. It was like coming home, even though until that point I hadn't realized I'd been away from home. I grew up in a Catholic environment, just for your information. And so once you get over this separatist mentality, you get exposed to this unlimited relational potential out there, and the organism intuitively recognizes the affiliation because that's where it comes from. That's how it developed in relation. And I don't mean just my own organism in my lifetime, but my type of organism, an organism that is essentially social through evolution. So when it comes to our social circle, the sky's the limit. Other humans, sure, other animals, but generally what I see, touch, smell, or experience in any other way, it all adds to this realm of experience that shapes me, and I can either ignore it or embrace it and open up to it. So at a minimum, there's the aspect of agency in others that affects us and that enables us to perceive them as agents and possibly persons. Now, this is not to say that if I, the human, can't perceive it, it doesn't exist. It's just to say that it is an agentive aspect and not necessarily a minor one, since perception will then inform attitude and action. And at the same time, of course, our own agency is subject to perception and evaluation by others, you know, human and non-human others. So while I may never know exactly what it feels like to be a bat or one of my sheep, are currently out here looking at what is we doing this morning. So, well, it's not hard for me to imagine them as persons with a human comparable consciousness. We share basic structures and processes. And, you know, over the years, I've also had a lot of interaction with non-human animals. And through this relating, we got to know one another, or at least parts of one another. I should break it up this little with a little quote here. It's not a quote, it's just a comment. And so when it comes to other agents, like animals seem quite easy to me. But when it comes to other agents, it may get a little bit complicated, like plants, for instance. We're discovering wonderful things about plants. And while it is difficult for me to imagine what plant consciousness may be like, it's not difficult to allow the possibility of plants being conscious in the sense of feeling themselves in some way that is comparable to the way we feel ourselves, but using a different system. Now, I do hope, though, that they don't feel pain or that they feel processed in some other way. Now, I'm biased here because I eat plants, but I actually do believe that there's a difference. Like, they have this amazing capacity for regeneration, and I just can't see how it could work if, say, cutting off a branch of a tree would hurt as much as cutting off my arm. Now, it wouldn't be very adaptive. It would be overwhelming for the organism, and pain's there to help us. It's a signal that something is harmful and we should try to do something about it. But with this incredible regeneration capacity of plants, it just must work somehow differently. Now, there's regeneration in the animal world, but it's not quite as extensive as in plants. So, to sum it up, we develop in a space of agencies, not just our parents and other animals, but also trees, the wind, the rain, the sun. They're all agents in relation to us, but also in their own right, and importantly, in relation to one another. Now, the current virus crisis is affecting humans on obviously so many levels, but it also gives us the opportunity to re-examine our values and our conduct. Now, we can't keep injecting disease into the planet and think everything's going to be fine, especially given that we do need a healthy planet for mere survival. We need fresh air, clean water, healthy soils to grow healthy foods, and we need healthy relationships. That's a little survival package. And so perhaps thinking of animal protection and environmental protection in conventional terms is not going to take us very far. We may need to start seeing them as sisters and as brothers, the miracles that they truly are, and change our internal system from one of instrumentalization to one of consideration and respect. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a great start input already into the theme today. What we will do is we have the four presentations without intercession and without questions in between, and then have the discussion after that. And the second speaker today is Whitney Baumann. He is associate professor of religious studies at Florida International University in Miami. And he is one of the co-founders and also co-directors of Counterpoint. His research and teaching interests focus on religion and science, religion, ecology, and nature. Most people in the audience here are probably aware of his work. He's currently working on a manuscript that deals with the ideas of Rachel Carson and Margie Stoneman Douglas. And he will share his thought about eco-persona and performativity, extending personal identity beyond the human. Please, Whitney, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Kaku. It's really great to be here and see so many familiar faces. I wish I could private message all of you, but instead I'm letting people in from the waiting room and managing the I'm managing the technology. If you know me, you know that's scary. So I don't have many notes to send, but I have a reference list, of course, which were all hyperlinked in my original document, but here they don't seem to be hyperlinked. But there's the name of the person you'll hear me say with the piece of work that that I'm referencing there. So if you want to follow up on any of these ideas, I'll just be sure to make note of when I'm referencing one of these people. And they're in order of my talk, so hopefully you can they're easy to follow. So I want to talk just about one part of sort of extending personal identity beyond the human in terms of an ecological personhood or ecological personhoods. And that has to do with time and the time of the modern Western person. So that's kind of what I want to focus on today. So if nothing else, life during this current pandemic is forcing us to reattune to the worlds in which we live. The things we thought were normal, took for granted, are all topsy-turvy, and this enables us to notice things like birdsong and stars. The social media is full of people like, are the birds louder now? And all the animals that have appeared in cities that they didn't think were there. So they were there, we're just noticing them more. Or even how much your partner clears his or her throat or clicks a pen while thinking, right? We're reattuning to the bodies around us in new ways because we're noticing different things because we have a different type of time. So this strange time enables a moment of reattunement to the world in which we live. And at its core, what I think of when I think of religion is reattuning. So etymologically, we can say religion is rereading or tying back together, reinterpreting. It's about this process of constant attunement to the worlds around us. So I think in many ways this moment provides a lot of opportunity for religious type moments. We might think about how meditation or yoga helps us to attune to places and embodiment just by slowing us down a little bit. Or how Moses, Muhammad, or Jesus helped people to attune to the oppressive worlds in which they lived. The world is constantly in flux, and reattunement is the mechanism by which we stay with the troubled worlds in which we live, as Donna Haraway might quip, in terms of staying with the trouble. So it's important to remember that there's not just this one world to reattune to, but I follow Walter Mignolo in this talk, a decolonial scholar, in talking about worlds within worlds and intertwined worlds. So there's many different worlds at any given moment that make up our own world, but also of which we make up. And none of these worlds is the sort of all-encompassing world, but at any given moment, the sort of sum of these worlds is what we might call the planetary, which is always constantly changing because the worlds are constantly changing. And Mignolo takes this idea of worlds among worlds from his work with the Zapatistas and the Zapatista movement. But I think that what we're realizing in terms of, those are just some of my theoretical bases there, but what we're realizing is that the performance of human being, of being human in a fossil-fueled reality is just too much for the regenerative capacity of the planet and for even our own bodies. I mean, I don't know how many of you are in academics, I know many of you are, but I think at the start of the summer, I had 5 different conference talks and different places around the world, and all that's canceled. And I'm in the same place for the longest period of time. I think since I've been in academics in the past 20 plus years as a grad student and then an assistant professor. So really different feeling to what's going on. Sorry, just letting someone else join there. Okay, so some humans live at the speed that moves bodies, energies, and materials around the planet at a dizzying pace, and one which the planetary systems and many planetary persons, human and not, just cannot sustain. Furthermore, fossil fuel time and the period sociologists refer to as the Great Acceleration since about 1945 is chronological and singular in time. This chronological singular time is the continuation of a progressive colonizing time, and it depends upon an individualized and human understanding of the person, the skin-encapsulated ego, the separate I of efficient causality. Personhood ends and begins with the stable, essential I right here. And in order to construct this type of human, humans must be separated from an instrumentalized nature in order to transform that nature towards certain human ends that we then end up calling progress. progress for whom? Progress for what? Is not something that this idea of progressive time necessarily questions. Again, as Walter Mignolo pointed out, and I give you this reference there, in the darker side of the Renaissance, what counts as the enlightened or enlightened human person is based upon Western, modern, and heteropatriarchal norms. So women, children, the poor, Black and brown peoples, indigenous peoples, and those with disabilities of many kinds have all been judged as in need of civilizing or enlightening, or in need of control, or as not worthy to count as human when judged against the normative modern human. So this essential personhood, in other words, this narrowing of what personhood is a race, class, sex type of personhood. And that's, I think, part of what we can see just by having a different understanding of time to unravel. We can see this idea of personhood beginning to unravel. So what happens when we slow down, when we find space to breathe, to begin to recognize the multiple times of the planet and see chronological time for what it is, the time of the colonizer? What happens when we see, along with Walter Benjamin, I gave you this reference there too, the angel of progress, facing backwards, being blown by the winds of history, watching all of the social and ecological tragedies that build up in the name of progress and chronological time. So it's not a torch moving forward as you have enlightenment, but an angel looking back at tragedy piling up, being blown by the random winds of history. Might there be more than just this modern human time? Can't we talk about the time of bees, rivers, mountains, and even a diversity of times within the human experience? Again, don't some religious experiences or mind-altering substances play with our sense of time and lay bare the notion that Chronos exists out there? One second, let one more person in here, sorry. So time is then, I'd argue, perspectival. And I use that in the way that some anthropologists are using this understanding. It's a function of the ways in which different bodies move together in different ways, causing friction along the way. So to quote David Abram here, in his book, Becoming Animal, I think I said that right? Yeah, Becoming Animal, good. We mistakenly think of our flesh as fixed and finite form, a neatly bounded package of muscle and bone and bottled electricity, with blood surging its looping boulevards and byways. But even the most cursory pondering of the body's manifold entanglements, its erotic draw toward other bodies, its incessant negotiation with that grander eros we call gravity, suffices to make evident that the body is less a self-enclosed sack than a realm wherein the diverse textures and colors of the world meet up with one another. I really like that quote. I've used it in a lot of places. So maybe we can think then about multiple times, as some are thinking about multiple embodiments and the influence of gravity on those different embodiments. Some speculative physicists, for instance, have argued for rainbow gravity and a corresponding rainbow time. I've given you the link to this also. As one article puts it, the color of light is determined by its frequency, and because different frequencies correspond to different energies, light particles or photons of different colors would travel on slightly different paths through space-time according to their energies. So different frequencies, different paths through space-time, different embodiments, multiple ways of becoming. This suggests a sort of multiplicity of the experience of time that is all sort of paved over with chronological time. So two primary ways that I want to talk about eco-persona or ecological personhood follow the work first of philosopher and particle physicist Karen Barad, who many of you have read before and know of, so it's nothing new, and her concept of agential realism and how it's basically flows of materials, affects, energy, information, all these sorts of things. Agency is sort of distributed throughout reality to the quantum level, out through the cosmic level. So everything is sort of acting, like actors in a network, if you want to follow Latour's language about it. And she even extends this to Judith Butler's concept of performativity, that what we consider natural laws are actually performances, not just willy-nilly, but they are performances of repetitions over time that then create the world in which we live, that we then call natural law or nature or reality or stability. So it's not just humans then that are these actors in a field of actants, but it's the rest of the natural world and all that we know as well. One way to think about it is this distributed agency is that our opposable thumbs or our language or the technology that enable us to be in front of each other right now, the neocortex, all these are things that we did nothing for, but enable us to be here. We don't cause these things. They're not part of our personhood, but they're part of multiple personhoods who've been evolving along the way together in communities that then enable our own personhood. So I would say they are agential persons, if you will, shaping the direction in which we and all other we's become. That's sort of one way of thinking about this ecological extension or redefining of personhood. Another way in which I have the reference here for is through Timothy Morton's understanding of hyper-objects. And basically, he flips on its head this idea that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts and says, no, the parts are more important than the whole. The whole is an emergent possibility that happens, but not without all of the parts that are very important. So again, he wants to focus in on the minutiae, on the parts, the ecotones, the microbiomes in our guts, right? The way in which our bodies are internalizations of the ecosystems and evolutionary processes that are external to us. The viruses and bacteria we can't even see. These are all performing us as persons in different ways. And most of them can exist without us, but our own personhood is the space that's provided from the interaction of all these other different entities. So it's not the far away, but the close up and troubled strange strangers, as Timothy Morton calls them, of our existence, that are what, letting someone else in. It's really just disturbed my flow if I ever had one. Okay, the troubled strange strangers of our existence are what are forcing us to reattune our lives and our worlds. It's not these sort of far off ideals and far off, holes of a new and beautiful world, but it's what's happening to the particulars of the world in which we live that force us to reattune to the world. The essential workers in our lives, right, that allow our lives to continue, that we've become so familiar with on a day-to-day basis because of this pandemic. So I think we need to talk about the time of the various parts of this, the whole. The whole will be emergent, not decided upon, but it emerges sympoetically from all these multiple persons moving along together at their different times, right? And then this sort of sympoetic emergence happens that we call the planetary, or our world in which we live. So eco-personhood would recognize then that we are embedded in this evolving planetary community, and that thousands of persons, whether they're systems, bacteria, earth bodies, climates, elements, what have you, make up our own personhood at any given time, just as we help to make up other personhoods. We are parts and wholes, objects and subjects, and worlds that lure us towards some performances, some ways of being over others. Having said that, I do want to emphasize, because this is one big critique of something like the new materialisms, and also queer theories even, that this is not an undoing of difference. I am not you, and you are not me. A human's not a hawk, nor a river, a forest. Differences matter, or as Judith Butler says, bodies matter. But they're not essentialist. They exist, these differences exist as the many different persons of the planetary processes evolve with one another. So differences are emergent in this interaction. So then in the end, hopefully, maybe what this different experience of time will help us do is to provide us with the opportunity to have critical reattunement to the world in which we live. And this means paying attention to how the worlds affect all peoples differently, not just humans, based upon what species they are, what size, shape, what time frame, what time they live in. Do they have a day long period, or do they have a 200 year period on the planet? And at least in the human world, these critical reattunements always have to deal also with class, race, sex, sexuality, and different types of abilities. So there, I think I'll end my little chat there. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Whitney. That was a very rich overview and input, and I'm curious how to put these all together in the discussion later. That will be interesting. But before we do that, we still have two more input presentations, and one by myself, and then one by David. My presentation or my input comes from a little bit different direction, but it is very closely related. And in my own contribution, I want to reflect a little bit on the epistemological and ethical issues that underlie the discussion of other than human personhood. Much of what we are talking about is deeply ingrained in ways of thinking that have been formed between the 18th and the 20th centuries, and that has already been alluded to. In this period, we see the emergence of a strong epistemological split between the observer and the observed, between the subject of thinking and the world as object. We take this as self-evident somehow, but it's interesting and important to reflect on the flexibility and the exceptional case in the larger framework of this interpretation. In this interpretation, even if the world can cause sensations and thus thinking, it still is the human intellect that judges about the world. This is a general idea in so-called Enlightenment thinking and in German idealism. And today is Immanuel Kant's birthday, and that is accidental, of course, but Immanuel Kant is a highly influential proponent of exactly this thinking. Although Kant did not think that the human understanding is a mirror of truth, rather this understanding exists within the limits of pure reason, as he calls it. And yet there is no knowledge outside of these limits that the human observer may access. What is more, while pure reason may be something beyond material reality, something a priori, if you want, it is always our language that has to present it, a second limitation we have to face. So we have this limit of our pure understanding and the linguistic limitation. And this linguistic limitation was later famously addressed by people like Ludwig Wittgenstein, who proclaimed in this Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, I quote, the limits of my language are the limits of my world. Yeah? So this is this understanding that We construct the knowledge about the world, and we present it through language. And I would argue that this idealist movement in general, and this idea in particular, can be regarded as one of the main influences of constructionist thinking in the 20th century, and particularly in the second half of the 20th century, this gained the upper hand in the social sciences and the humanities in particular. And what we see, I would argue, now with the emergence of new revisiting materialist ideas and also object-oriented ontologies. And so it's a kind of response to this constructionist. It's also a critique of this constructionist thinking that is so built and based somehow on the subject-object distinction. So if we regard this as a kind of prison that we are in, how can we look for tunnels, or where can we drill tunnels out of this? Because it is quite obvious that such an approach can easily lead to an anthropocentric idea of knowledge and understanding. And many people are not happy with that anymore. Non-human personhood and non-human agency inevitably is something we attribute to non-human things. In an attempt to find alternatives to this unavoidable anthropocentrism that comes out of this tradition, several solutions have been proposed. Let me point out two general directions we may choose to drill this tunnel out of this conceptual and epistemological prison. One has to do with language, and the other with ethics. To revisit language first, and of course that's a huge topic, but just briefly to sketch a few proposed ideas that have been made. In contrast to the Wittgenstein of the Tractatus, others, and including the later Wittgenstein, to be sure, experimented with alternative forms of understanding language. That started already in Romanticism, where poetic dimensions of language could be part of epistemological scrutiny. This led to a long trajectory of what's referred to as poetic science. Famous proponents are Goethe, Shelley, or Blake. And this is still influential today. Another experimentation with language and philosophy was philosophical phenomenology. At the beginning of the 20th century through today, from Edmund Husserl to Martin Heidegger and beyond, and this direction looked at the ways reality shines through, that's the original Greek meaning of phenomenon, shines through language, which means that it is not a direct mirror of truth, but something that makes visible something that has been that had been hidden. But it also means that you have to come up with new terms and words to directly convey the meaning of an idea, which also makes it so hard to read Heidegger, because he comes up with all these invented new words, even for a native German speaker. But anyway, so that was one direction. And to add a third one is what today is called the eco-criticism direction. And let me paste you a quote here from Iovino and Oppermann from a material eco-criticism volume. And there they say that the world's material phenomena are knots in a vast network of agencies, which can be read and interpreted as forming narratives, stories. The stories of matter are everywhere, in the air we breathe, the food we eat, in the things and beings of this world within and beyond the human realm. All matter, in other words, is a storied matter. It is a material mesh of meanings, properties, and processes in which human and non-human players are interlocked in networks that produce undeniable signifying forces. It's a little bit jargony, I think, this direction, but what is clear from this is that the idea of language and textuality is widened and also applied to materiality and to the world as a whole. But this revised orientation when it comes to language also includes approaches that invite non-human languages into the conversation. And David Abram is an excellent proponent of exactly this approach, and we've seen that already in Whitney's contribution. And I'm very excited to have him here in our round table today. In Becoming Animal, an Earthly Cosmology, David argues for the need to open up the human body to the languages of other critters and to the entire world. I have another quote here for the chat. Let me see. Obviously, David maintains, these other beings do not speak with a human tongue. They do not speak in words. They may speak in song, like many birds, or in rhythm, like the crickets and the ocean waves. They may speak a language of movements and gestures, or articulate themselves in shifting shadows. Becoming aware of their animal bodies, human beings learn to use their senses in a long-forgotten way. This is an extension of the understanding of language beyond the human. And David's notion of animal bodies already hints at a way of communicating with a world that is not built on linguistic structures. Since the first Earth Day 50 years ago, animal studies, ecology, and new philosophical discussions have strongly enhanced what I call the provincialization of the human. The materialist and ontological turns are critiques of constructionist approaches. They decenter human hegemony in ethics and epistemology. And it's interesting to see that they can be built into theoretical frameworks that are traditionally constructionist, like my own scholarly habitat, which is discourse theory, where you can see that it is very easy to extend the term discourse community to non-human factors and actors who together form a communicative system in which meaning is produced. That's what discourses do. In this communicative system, meaning emerges from the encounter of all involved without privileging one part of the system. So it's just an example of how you can see that this widening of the reference frame, if you want, or the provincialization of the human can be captured even in constructivist theoretical frames. But then that's the last part I want to look into. But even then, there remain serious challenges, and critics argue that despite all these attempts, it will always be impossible to overcome the epistemological breach between our observing and analyzing mind and the things we encounter. I have here two sources. One is Dieter Grob, who's famous in formulating this very distinctly with regard to our understanding of nature. And more recently, you have Slavoj Žižek in his 2014 book, Absolute Recoil Towards a New Foundation of Dialectical Materialism, where he offers a critique of this new theoretical turn, arguing that in their attempt to overcome dualistic and anthropocentric thinking, new materialisms and object-oriented ontologies re-inscribe these humanist values they critique by merely extending agency, vitality, and social phenomena to the non-human world. What is more, all these non-linguistic approaches are presented in books and lectures like this, what we do here, which is ironic and shows how much we are dependent on linguistic frames of communication. So to drive this home, my answer to these critics and my input to our discussion is that indeed, we won't be able to overcome the situation that we are located in a distinct way within these planetary networks of communication. Being located in this way means that we shouldn't pretend to be able to present the others, humans and non-humans, by the way, perspective in an objective way. Our understanding is limited to what we process within our own physical and mental system. This moves the focus from epistemology to ethics, I would argue. Even if we don't claim to represent all perspectives in a balanced system of truth, we apply an idea of polyfocality and we provide space for human and non-human others to be part of the conversation, be it linguistic or otherwise. The result is a planetary ethics, exactly as Whitney is developing it. Providing such a space for communication and acknowledgement is an acceptance of our responsibility to act as human inhabitants of this planet, who become with, as Haraway would say, become with other beings. We simply invite others to the table, and in doing so, we don't deny that we come from a certain and a different perspective. Like what Whitney said, it's not an undoing of differences, quite the contrary. We acknowledge that even the term personhood is a generalization of human perspectives. A stone or a bird would probably not even know what we mean by a person. Rather, they would operate in terms of stonehood and birdhood that they may or may not attribute to us. I'm pretty sure my dog attributes doghood to me, as I am a member of the pack. Whether or not the birds I'm feeding at home attribute birdhood to me, I'm not so sure. So what I mean is that we shouldn't confuse anthropocentrism with anthropomorphism. Yes, it is us as individual beings who attribute personhood to non-human others. In this sense, we still go along with Kant. But it is no longer anthropocentric, as the non-human others have their own right to look at us from their distinct location. Moving from epistemology to ethics means that we should regard ourselves as a good host of this planetary conversation. We aren't necessarily stewards, but simply hosts of a conversation, and we do our best for the well-being of our ethical others. Our role is based on our appreciation of the more than human world. This is what Ursula K. Le Guin, in one of her last publications, called admiration. And with this quote, I will end my talk, but I will paste this for you. By admiration, Le Guin says, I understand reverence for the infinite connectedness, the naturally sacred order of things, and joy in it, delight. So we admit stones to our holy communion, so the stones may admit us to theirs. Thank you very much. Okay, so I have to change my speaker's role, and it's my pleasure to introduce the last speaker of this first round, and that is David Abram. I don't think David needs actually an introduction. Everyone basically knows him as an American philosopher, cultural ecologist, and performance artist. And he's best known for his work bridging the philosophical tradition of phenomenology with environmental and ecological issues. He's the author of Becoming Animal, that's what I quoted in my contribution, from 2010, and also the author of The Spell of the Senses, Perception and Language in a More Than Human World, from 1896, for which he received, among other awards, the International Lenin Literary Award for Nonfiction. He's a fellow at Schumacher College, and he's also the co-founder and creative director of the Alliance for Wild Ethics. We're very happy to have you here, David, and I give you the floor.
Thank you, Kaku. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I'm enjoying this a lot and really digging what you were saying about birdhood and doghood and stonehood, but really enjoying this whole conversation. Yeah, so I'm David. I'm a cultural ecologist with a particular fascination in the ecology of perception, or what we could call the ecology of sensory experience, the way the activity of our eyes, of our ears, of our skin functions to bind our separate nervous systems into the encompassing ecosystem. But I'm just as interested in the ecology of language, how what we say so profoundly influences what we see, or what we hear, or even taste of the earth around us. Because I'm convinced that there are ways of speaking that many of us have inherited that function to stifle and close down that instinctive rapport between our animal senses and the earthly sensuous. But I'm just as convinced that there are other ways of speaking that can actually work to open, to encourage, to enhance that spontaneous reciprocity between the human body and the animate earth. So I want to just leap in, offer up a couple reflections, one on the intelligence of other creatures, and one a vignette in regard to a rock. So how easy it is for inherited concepts to stifle our senses. So often we assume that animals are not conscious, that birds, for example, lack real intelligence since their brains or their brain-body ratios are way smaller than ours. Bird brains, we say, a facile insult. Intelligence, we assume, is a strictly centralized phenomenon, mistaking our distinctively human form of intelligence for intelligence itself. As a mammal who long ago learned to balance on its hind legs, freeing its forepaws to manipulate objects, we specialize in a kind of curiosity that looks at things from different directions, turning them this way and that, a highly visual pondering that seems to unfold somewhere behind our eyes. It's a propensity for detachment that has been greatly intensified in the current epoch. An expanding complex of technologies now mediate between our body and the earthly elements. Instead of navigating the elements directly, we're accustomed to adjusting the switches on these technologies, using our intelligence to maneuver among a determinate set of abstract parameters rather than to improvise our way through an indeterminate and ever-shifting material field. When driving our cars or while sitting in airplanes, we're accustomed to fairly mechanical operations that require little strenuous effort. Whether sequestered in our offices, tickling the keys on a keyboard, or simply turning the pages of a good book in bed, we spend much of our time deploying a very rarefied form of intelligence, manipulating abstract symbols, while our muscled body is mostly inert. And so thinking for us seems to have little bearing on our carnal life. It often seems entirely independent of our body and our bodily relation to the biosphere. If our reflections do result in a change of stance or an alteration in our actions, they still seem to issue as directives from a centralized thinker or self, oddly independent of our materiality, a floating locus of awareness situated somewhere within our heads. Well, other animals in a constant and mostly unmediated relation with their sensory surroundings, think with the whole of their bodies. A nuanced creativity is necessary to orient and forage in a world of ever-changing forces. Equipped with proclivities and patterned behaviors genetically inherited from its ancestors, each wild critter must nonetheless adapt such propensities to the elemental particulars of the place and moment where it finds itself. From an unexpected absence of water in the usual watering hole to a sudden abundance of its favorite food. No matter how precise are the instructions tucked into its chromosomes, they can hardly have encoded in advance the exact topology of the present moment. And so a modicum of creative engagement in its immediate circumstance is simply unavoidable for any organism that moves, whether an elephant or an amoeba or a human. It is unavoidable for any organism that must orient itself now and then to the rest of a steadily transforming reality. A spider sets about mending her web after it's torn by a pounding rain, adding only those strands necessary to patch the precise dimensions of the whole. A monkey still skillfully adjusts the strength of his arboreal leaps to match the distances of the various branches that loom up one in front of another. A foraging bull elk, stymied in his attempt to rejoin the herd by a newly flooding river, assesses his chances. Will he plunge into ford the swollen waters or wait out the tumult? Some might say that such decisions are not thoughts, that the animal is not aware of these choices. But man, I mean, it's clear something is aware in the present moment, monitoring the terrain and responding accordingly. It's true that we don't need to attribute such choices to a separable self within the animal or to a thinking that unfolds entirely in some autonomous part of the creature's brain before issuing its clear commands to the limbs. Never having separated their sentience from their sensate bodies, having little reason to sequester their intelligence in a separate region of their skull where it might dialogue steadily with itself, many undomesticated animals, when awake, move in a fairly constant dialogue, not with themselves, but with their surroundings. Here, it's not an isolated mind, but rather the sensate muscled body that is doing the thinking. Its diverse senses and its flexing limbs playing off one another as it feels out fresh solutions to problems posed, adjusting old habits and ancestral patterns to present circumstances. This kind of distributed sentience, this intelligence in the limbs, is especially keen in birds of flight. Unlike most critters of the ground who have to traverse an opaque surface of only 2+ dimensions as we make our way through the world, a soaring bird continually adjusts minute muscles in its wings to navigate an omnidimensional plenum of currents and interference patterns that alter from moment to moment. An unseeable flux compounded of gusting winds and whirling eddies, of blasts and updrafts and sudden calms, of storm fronts, temperature gradients, and countless other temperamental vectors and flows that may invisibly and at any moment impinge upon your feathered trajectory, whether from in front or above or below, shoving you from one side or the other or from several directions all at once. Flying is an uninterrupted improvisation with an unseen and wildly metamorphic partner. In order to stay aloft and on course, whether toward a certain stand of trees or toward an unsuspecting rodent moving among the grasses, tactile and kinesthetic sensations registering changes in the unfolding currents have to translate instantly into muscular adjustments, diverse sinews flexing and extending to counter such perturbations, even as those currents keep shifting in a dynamic rolling exchange between your wing muscles and the rushing muscle of the wind itself. It's a kinetic conversation in the uttermost thick of the present moment. A barn swallow swooping, dipping, and banking for insects, a kestrel hovering directly above a field mouse, a crowd of crows mobbing a hawk, the bald eagle I once watched diving talons first toward a young loon, a gull kiting in the wind just above me, keeping perfect pace with the ferry I'm riding. Whatever other styles of savvy these creatures may or may not display, all of them, while aloft, are thinking exquisitely along the whole length of their extended limbs. It's a brilliance we're ill-equipped to notice if we associate smartness only with our own very centralized style of cogitation, when we disparage the intelligence of birds or the size of their brains, we miss that flight itself is a kind of thinking, a gliding within the mind, a grace we humans rarely attain in our contemplations. Although, if we're following a falcon with our focus, we sometimes find our thoughts soaring as well. So that's one reflection, zeroing in on one particular gang of our confreres and sisters, the feathered folk. But of course, every critter has its outrageous style of sentience, and every individual within each species has its unique. Well, let me give just contrast this with a different example of a sense of personhood, perhaps, or agency. Consider a large rock, about 3 or 4 feet in diameter, its irregular bulk reposing upon the ground. Whether or not such a rock sits on the earth anywhere near where you find yourself hearing these words, there is such a rock resting just outside the house where I'm sitting here speaking them. I'm not very sure of its composition, although it has a similar color to the sandstone rocks that sprawl around it. I know from close inspection that it doesn't have their granular texture, but a more dense and continuous solidity riven by jagged edges along its surface. Patches of quartz, dully translucent, are visible here and there, embedded in the pink matrix. I glance at it now and then through the small window, offering its shade to the clumped grasses, implacable in its solidity, a familiar and stable presence amid all of my whirling thoughts. Do you know any such rock? No matter its composition or color, is there not some similar stone with whom you are acquainted, a rock whose stable persistence offers a kind of anchor when dreams or worries threaten to carry you away, a dependable presence that provides, at the very least, a place to lean against and rest your limbs? Well, after I've been adrift in words and sentences for a long stretch, I look up and I find that rock once again poised in that same stance, holding its familiar shape against the trees and the blue sky, although the shadow that it casts upon the ground has now shifted. I return to my work. After an hour or so, it calls my gaze once again. The sky behind that rock is now dense with cloud, and so its shadow has been subsumed within the common shade. And yet the stone still maintains its earlier stance. And I'm suddenly struck by the immense exertion it would take to hold myself in such a stable posture, moment after moment, without flinching, to sustain itself in that position steadily, so that even now it is still bearing that very shape, and still again, and yet again, hour after hour, and day after day. That must take a lot of effort. I mean, not, of course, that the rock has to deal with the kind of mad restlessness that besets a muscled being like myself, but simply to hold itself together in a cosmos that is steadily flying apart, to prevail year after year against the suck of entropy, seems already to entail a kind of stubbornness, an obdurate persistence that we miss when we think of being or bare existence as a purely passive state. And so I find myself staring at this rock with a new astonishment, a new appreciation for its compacted energy, the wild activity that it displays by its simple presence. It seems to me the age-old bifurcation between spirit and matter prompts us to take bare existence for granted, to assume that a simple material presence like a stone or a mountain is utterly passive and inert. We say that the rock is here, that the mountains are over there. We use this little verb, to be, countless times every day. And yet we forget that it is a verb, that it names an act, that simply to exist is a very active thing to be doing. By suppressing this activity, by taking being entirely for granted as a purely passive state, we flatten the wild contingency of existence, the uncertainty and risk of the present moment. We lock in the closet our vague puzzlement at finding ourselves here in this very place at this very moment of the world's unfolding. Why is there something rather than nothing? This is the question philosophers have used to unsettle our complacency regarding the weirdness of existence, to stir us from our forgetfulness, to reawaken our sense of wonder. But it's enough already to just notice the inherent dynamism of the present moment, to notice that mere existence is already an upsurge and not a blank and passive floating, in order to retrieve the sensuous world from the oblivion to which our concepts all too often consign it. A solitary rock or a clear-cut stump is utterly inanimate only as long as being itself is taken to be static and inert. Our animal senses, however, know of no such passive reality. They perceive things only by interacting with them, by entering into relation with their rhythms of disclosure and concealment, their allurement or their reticence. To my animal body, this rock is first and foremost another body engaged in the world. As I turn my gaze toward it, I encounter not a defined and inanimate chunk of matter, but an upturned surface basking in the sun's warmth, or a pink and sharp-edged structure protruding from the ground like the shattered bone of the hillside, or an old and watchful guardian of this land, a resolute and sheltering presence inviting me now to crouch and lean my spine back against it. Each thing organizes the space around it, rebuffing or sidling up against other things. Each thing calls, gestures, beckons to other beings, or battles them for our attentions. Things expose themselves to the sun or retreat among the shadows, shouting with their loud colors or whispering with their seeds. Rocks snag lichen spores from the air and shelter spiders under their flanks. Clouds converse with the fathomless blue and metamorphose into one another. They spill rain upon the land, which gathers in rivulets and carves out canyons. Skyscrapers slice the winds and argue with one another over the tops of townhouses. Backhoes and songbirds are coaxed into duets by the percussive rhythm of the subway beneath the street. Things catch our eye and sometimes refuse to let it go. They grab our focus or capture our attention and finally release us from their grasp, only to dissolve back into the overabundant world. Whether ecstatic or morose, exuberant or exhausted, everything swerves and trembles. Anguish, equanimity, and pleasure are not first internal moods, but passions granted to us by the capricious terrain. Thanks.
Thank you so much, David. That was a wonderful contribution and description, and very poetic one too. So I don't have a clue how to put these four contributions together, and I don't make an attempt even to do that. But I'd like to, before we open up the discussion to the whole group, I'd like to invite the other panelists to share their thoughts about what the others have said. And maybe I'd like to ask Thea first, if you want to have some, want to come back to some of what the others have said and link that to your own perspectives or to discussion points you'd like to bring up?
Of course. Yes or no. I mean, like, there's so much to say. Everything's just been fantastic. I've really enjoyed this. But we're also kind of running out of time a little bit, and it would be good to give the voice to others. I just want to say two things. One is it relates to David's presentation, but also to others. I live with this sheep here. And you know about the mirror recognition test, you know, some animals pass it. It's supposed to show how animals are aware of themselves and intelligent, stuff like that. And so I have a mirror here, and Jason, one of the sheep, is just intrigued by it and just comes in every day and looks at himself there. Now, he's not supposed to recognize himself in the mirror because sheep are, you know, too dumb for that. But I've noticed that, you know, for a few days, he was just looking and looking, and I help him. Like, I went, you know, to him so he could see me there, so sort of to help him to recognize himself, like to help him realize that it was him. And then he started to rub himself on the mirror. And then I realized, oh, okay, like, you know, it's you, but it doesn't smell like you. So you just sort of want, you know, and it's about, you know, using your entire body and all your senses as opposed to just what we think they should be using to recognize themselves in various ways. And the other thing is we have this wild rabbit who comes every morning to play with the sheep. I have cameras installed around just for safety reasons, also to see what's going on at night and stuff. And I think it's lovely because it's totally unrelated to us. You know, it's just like a wild rabbit that maybe has his social circle somewhere else or not or whatever. But he comes every morning and plays with my sheep and sort of, you know, goes around them, runs around them, scratches their noses and things like that. So there's this relationality, I guess, and this relationability that, you know, is way beyond language. And that's basically what I think allows us, enables us to relate to others, you know, whether they're linguistic creatures, the way, you know, we define language or not.
Thank you. Whitney, what do you want to?
I also I really enjoyed all the other papers. Mine was terrible, but I loved all of yours. It was really great. It's just like one thing that strikes me is the whole sort of zooming in and zooming out function of the different talks. That it is this whole it's the fascination with the particular that allows you to see the interconnectedness of the larger whole. And I think probably we could each of us in this whole Zoom call could go and sort of talk about that place or that particular thing that led to this realization of the interconnectedness of the planetary or whatever you want to call it. But it's always a zoom in that somehow gets you to the zoom out. And I found that in all three of the, or all the talks. So it's really just a comment, no real questions.
Yeah. David?
I thought these talks all worked and fit together rather well. Just a couple threads I would pluck. There was something, I think it was Whitney said that this is not an undoing of difference. And I think that's such a key piece, and I want to strengthen it a bit, because I'm sometimes, you know, I seem to be inadvertently an animist. I'm unable to experience anything as utterly inert and inanimate. So it's a simple shorthand to just allow that everything's alive. But if one gets hung up on the word alive, you could just say everything has agency. But this sense of everything alive, people say, oh, yes, so that just, you're saying it's all one. No, it's the opposite of that. It's not saying everything is the same. That in a sense, our weirdly dualist frames that we've inherited, for instance, thinking of the mind as one thing, the body as something else, or spirit as one dimension and matter as some other dimension, that these dualisms function to occlude or eclipse not oneness, They hide multiplicity. They hide the outrageous richness and multiplicitous weirdness of things. If I allow that everything is animate from the get-go, or that everything is alive, then I get to ask that sandstone boulder, what is your way of living? Or this cedar tree, you know, how do you dance with the wind and with the elements? And how is that different from the way this pine, this ponderosa pine tree just next to you is doing? That is, each thing then begins to disclose its inescapable and unfathomable strangeness and unique qualities. So to me, it's not only not an undoing of a difference, it is an opening up of multiplicity, a radical pluralism, because each body, each being, each presence, by virtue of its shape, its texture, is already different, richly different from every other body in its vicinity, including those of its own species. So that was one thought. And I think another was linked to something Kaku mentioned at some point in passing, that our understanding is, we can't pretend to know objectively what the perspective of another being is. And I'd, of course, agree with that. But then you follow that by saying, because our understanding is limited to what we process in our own biophysical sort of nervous system. And I wonder a little bit whether, because we have co-evolved with all these other shapes and forms and rhythms and dances in this biosphere, whether our nervous system is not really closed in on itself, that it's already informed by the howling of wolves and the honking of geese, that somehow the human nervous system and episteme is not closed in on itself, but opens of its very nature onto other epistemes, onto other other styles of experience that already in some ways compose us. So that's one other thought. And then finally, and I would just, the question of personhood, given that this is Earth Day, I suppose some folks might wonder about, what about Earth itself as a person or as an agency or as a presence, that we nonetheless only experience a small part of, or small piece of, or multiple small aspects of at any moment. And the thought that's just coming to me about that is, whenever people begin thinking of Earth as a living agent or presence, or as an entity or a being, they say, oh, well, okay, Abram, you can suggest that, but then, you know, is it like an animal or is it like a plant? As if there were just these two ways of being alive, or is it like a person? But it seems to me that if we think about it and reflect and feel into it, as I'm sure many of you have done, we'll notice that if Earth itself is a living physiology, if it's this immense metabolism, spherical metabolism in which our individual physiologies are all embedded, well, then we have to radically rethink what it is to be an animal, to be a plant, to be even a person, because it turns out animals, plants, and persons all borrow from the spherical archetype. That's the presence, that spherical being that informs, and we all sort of borrow from and work various variations on. So just that, those are thoughts that come to me.
Thanks a lot. I think that this, things come together quite nicely. And I think it strikes me that we are talking about similarities and at the same time about differences. And we unpack these in different ways. So there is this similarities on the one hand between us as persons and non-human persons or others, which with whom we co-evolve. So there is this kind of similarity in ways that we break down differences that have been constructed in our own tradition. And I'm glad that you point that out. We are, of course, part, our physical system is part of this whole relationship that we have with the others. So that's one point of the similarities. And at the same time, we point out differences and we construct differences in different ways, maybe than we have been told or our culture has told us to articulate these differences. And these similarities and differences come together in kind of entanglement and relationality that defines their features in ever-changing ways. So that's what I take home a little bit from this. But I think it's time to open up the discussion to others. And I wonder if Whitney wants to take over here.
Sure, I can do that. So I sent in the group chat just to submit a question, and I'll do my best to work my way down. And maybe we'll answer yours before we get to yours. And if that's the case, then I'll move to the next one. But our first person here is a question from Lisa Sedaris about attunement. Do you want to, Lisa, I unmuted you so you can talk now.
Okay. Wow, I feel so special getting unmuted. my question, I mean, it's really kind of a comment. I was struck by the word attunement that came up originally in Whitney's talk about how we're attuned to time and maybe we need to reattune ourselves in some ways. And David's talk about the way that organisms, you know, attune themselves to their physical space. You've got sort of the time dimension and the space dimension. But just thinking about the word attunement, this is being a kind of something to dwell on a bit, because it has these dimensions of music and harmony, being in tune with things, but also I think is related to atonement etymologically, which was interesting. So just thinking of kind of retuning ourselves in some way as a kind of atonement. It's just a theme that sort of
stood out to me. No, I think so. I like this a lot. And in other places, I'm working towards a sort of more understanding religion as a critical reattunement to the worlds. And that critical part is that atonement part. So recognizing that due to your own embodiment, you get privileges or disadvantages just from the way that your body is. And so that not every body in the world experiences the same world, right? And so that's part of that. That's why you need critical theories. And they're always said there can't just be a sort of romanticism. There has to be a critical romanticism that recognizes that this is an embodied, mediated experience at some level. I mean, for me, that's the way I'm trying to think about it. But I have no idea if the two words are related, actually. Atonement and attunement, maybe they are.
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of did a quick search and that surprised me. That's sort of what jumped out at me, is it looks like they might be connected.
Yeah, I mean, because in order to attune, you have to atone a bit for your armored, closed off way of so easily not relating very deeply. So there, atonement is a first step, it would seem, in attunement.
Very good. Thank you. Okay, so the next question we have is from Emily Wayne, and I'm just unmuting you here if I can. There we are.
Hello,
okay,
and I'm Emil, not Emily.
Sorry.
Thanks. So my question tries to pull together a lot of the different aspects of the conversation, but with respect to and attention to more current events. So if we're trying to think beyond language, how can our attention to affect as the kind of pulsation of our emotive, embodied, entangled, extended being in the world that's in integrally extended and entangled with others, although not in perfect ways, help us to understand the allure of reactionary ideologies, fake news, narratives of blood and soil, blatantly false, intellectually demonstrably unsound ideologies in times of crisis? And I think connected to that, how can attention to what Whitney was talking about, our interconnected, haunted, multi-species timescapes and rhythms, complicate and challenge normative colonizer progress time, also help us do the same in this sort of Anthropocene moment?
Easy. Anybody else want to take a first go? I'm still trying to collect my thoughts here.
You framed, Emil, you framed the question as, you know, as if we're trying to think beyond language, but in some way, at least some of us are not necessarily trying to think beyond language, although we're thinking beyond verbal language, but opening up a sense of language as much more expansive, and that everything has its expressive potency. Everything, it seems to me, even a gust of wind. And within that, something I was getting from Whitney is this sense of worlds within worlds within worlds, or timings or rhythms inside other rhythms, inside other rhythms, multiple rhythms, or dances unfolding within the larger dance of my organism, which is a part of this interplay of so many different styles of gesture and movement within just the local ecology of this piece of land where I live. And I think it has everything to do with that opening to radical pluralism, radical multiplicity, that everything, if one allows that everything, every material agency or immaterial agency, has its vitality, its pulse, its rhythm, its interior animation, then the allure, I think that undercuts the possibility of getting so drawn in and allured by the kinds of scapegoating rhetorics that just want to say, there's two things. There's us and there's those bastards out there, or the various forms of us and them and blame and pinning things on a single cause and all of that, those ugly rhetorics you rightly point to.
And I also think maybe I also still have to think about this question, but I have the impression that this is really also a way to link what Whitney said about the time and about language. Because if you, for instance, if you talk about a stone or a rock who has its own or his or her or their own way of communicating with the environment, with the clouds, with the light, with everything, and then after 2 million years there's a break in it or something. So there's a way of communicating with the environment and embodied energy and so on, like what David talked about. But that's also in a way that can be regarded as a form of language, to communicate with the world, with the environment. And then the timing of that language is entirely different than what we normally call language, or like the ocean, like the waves or whatever. A communicating, talking planet in a way is on the one hand the different time, and at the same time it's also very different than from what we usually call communication. So I think that might be also a way to link this language, rethinking language and rethinking time in a way that comes close to what Whitney was talking about.
I mean, I would just add that I think that in terms of the question about multiplicity and interconnectedness and attention to these different embodied entanglements and fake news and sort of blood and soil return to nationalism types of things. I mean, I think that these fake news is exactly rejecting entanglement. It's exactly rejecting this sort of planetary interconnectedness to things by saying no. Whatever my truth is, the truth that is going to be enforced, right? It's that sort of colonial imposition upon the rest of the planet. At least that's the way I look at it. So, I guess that's sort of a start to an answer to that. But thanks, Emil. Sorry, I said Emily at first. Okay, the next question we have is from Samsul. Let's see if I can find you on here. Sorry, it's a little, there we are. If I can unmute, are you there, Samsul?
Yes.
Okay, please let us know what your, tell us what your question is.
Yes, thank you very much. First You're of welcome. All, thank you very much. For
Thank
the...
you for joining us from Indonesia.
Oh, wow.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's 6 a.m. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it very much. I love this. I love this. I have been also actually engaged with this topic. And so my first question is that this is so beautiful. This is so beautiful not only for dealing with the environments, but even like for those who are working in peace building, this is a very good, thinking, I think, to bring up in, like peace building. And so my question in relation to that, you all have, said that personhood beyond humans implies about the multiplicity differences for connecting to one another. So how can we anticipate for having so many different persons, including non-human persons, given the fact that even understanding personhood only to human being, we have already so many conflicts, among us. I mean, even if we limit, personhood to even, the fact that anthropomorphism, we have had that tradition for very so long. We limit personhood only to humans. So only one kind of person, but we already have conflicts among us, among human beings. And so how can we anticipate this concept by expanding it, meaning giving agencies to many others as persons that could also create conflicts? I'm trying to think in different ways just to challenge this, I love these ideas. And so the second one, I think still related to it, again, understanding or taking this as a very good way of thinking. What have you all observed about the most challenging thought agencies, for this thought to develop, for this thought, to spread out? In dealing with the environment, dealing with, with whatever situation for this thought to be, accepted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anshu.
Taya, you want to jump in?
I just wanted to say that it's very challenging. I used to think, like you explain to people certain things that you've discovered about animals. For example, animals, it could be anything else, right? Humans. They're sensitive and sentient and stuff like that, intelligent. And people will go, oh my God, of course, I've been doing all these bad things. I'm going to change my way. And it doesn't work like that. Going to the previous, to Emily's. Emil's question, sorry, it's like there's nothing sort of a lot of the stuff is intellectually unsound about ideologies and even just normal, like non-ideological thinking, but that's what we are, affective creatures and ultimately herd animals. And the challenge right now is, like I was reading the other day, someone, it was kind of nicely put, he said, you know, you can't convince someone to change their mind about anything really, unless you give them a new herd, you know, if you take an idea away from him or, you know, the way they eat or, you know, what they eat, who they eat, whatever, you have to give them a new herd. Otherwise, they're just, they are lost. And we herd animals, I'm not sure. And I thought it was a nice way to put it. And we live in a globalized society right now. So the challenge is, and I don't have a recipe for it, obviously, is to bring people to see the entire planetary community, but even just, you know, human beings to start with, as a herd, you know, our herd. And I think one of the way to will help getting there is to actually give people what they need just in terms of basic things. You know, the happier people, in my opinion and in my experience, are sort of more willing to be nice to others, you know, if you don't have to fight all over the place for your own survival. And so I think that actually doing something as opposed to just talking a lot about it, to give people some basic things that they just need to survive would be a good start. And just, you know, not just look away, you know, from homelessness and from, you know, starvation and stuff like that. So I think that's it. That's an important component and really sort of seeing as one another as connected, because we are, I mean, like it's, we just are, you know, we always have been sort of, but right now we are even more, and it's just, we are one herd and let's just be nice to each other. How to get there? I don't know. You know, I'm not sure I understood the second question though. So this is basically a contribution to the first.
Well, the second question, as I heard it, was about some of the most difficult agencies, if one is allowing or that agency is everywhere. And certainly one of the most difficult agencies we've ever dealt with is this coronavirus. And yet, for all its difficulty and the tragedies it is bringing to our kind in particular. It's also, as this, you know, plague sweeps like a tsunami across the land, at least here in North America, it's sweeping away all of the flimsy facades that have covered over the massive injustice, the massive inequities, the massive structural violence within the society, so that it's not possible, and I don't think it'll be possible quite so easily to turn away from or hide from all of that structural violence that you were just also speaking to, Teo. So I saw that link, but I wanted to say a word also to the first question of the last gentleman whose name I forget, but that he was saying, listen, if we, even just recognizing personhood among ourselves, have so much problem and violence sparks up readily, how much more complex and problematic it may be if we're going to then allow personhood way beyond the human. And I just wanted to say to that it seems to me that it's precisely by allowing agency or some quality of vitality or vibrance to everything, that then that takes the strength off of our interhuman relations, where we're just trading around all of this mana or eros just among ourselves, because we are the only ones who are really present in the world, really conscious, really aware. Well, that brings so much brittleness to our human affairs, even one's affairs of the heart, one's intimate relationships or family relationships, but also international relations are all mighty brittle, in a way that eases tremendously if one allows that everything else also is participant in our negotiations, and that we've got the active support of the ground underfoot and the active nourishment offered by all the plants who are providing the oxygen that we take in and breathe. That is, there are many, many other beings lending a hand, and it becomes much less easy in such a pluralist cosmos to fall back on simple othering and scapegoating. So it seems.
I just wanted to agree with this. when I was first reading about plant rights, I thought, you know, as a vegan, I went defensive like most others do. But I was reading Michael Marder, the philosopher, and I totally support plant rights as he defines them, or at least as he did in 2013. I haven't actually read anything after that. But one of the key points he was making was the need for deinstrumentalization, you know, to deinstrumentalize life. And that's what you were talking about right now. And I think that would be really important. And, you know, that old story about, or the cartoon about how to teach a child not to step on a caterpillar is as useful to the caterpillar as it is to the child. And ultimately, that is true, because that, you know, when we have that kind of openness inside, I think that it makes us less anxious, you know, and less protective of something that, you know, we're trying to protect. We don't even know what it is, but it's basically, you know, this little hurt thing. So I think that, yes, opening up to the rest of the world would make us less defensive, and I think better to each other as well.
All right. Thank you for that question. We have time for a couple more questions, so I'll go to the next one, which is Anne-Marie Hauser. Are you still there?
I am.
Can you hear me? Oh, great. We can hear you.
Okay. Well, my question actually was a little bit covered by Anil, so if you don't mind, I'd like to just modify it slightly.
Sure.
So my question was just that, like, bringing into proximity, yeah, your different ways of speaking, all of you, about enfolding an enfolding cognitive structure, whether that's the Kantian pure reason or it's speaking from a psychological perspective, schemas. So at first I wanted to ask y'all to speak to the somatic, like sort of intercorporeal communication. And I guess I was thinking about, you know, how meeting other beings body to body could be a way of moving through that somewhat enfolding. But since you guys kind of spoke a little bit to that, what about the challenges to doing that, especially now that we're all, some of us are kind of siloed in our flats in the cities, you know? And, you know, if kineticism offers a way of knowing, and you know, we're all sitting here, some of us more withdrawn from the non-human world, more than human world than we were before. What challenges does that pose, thinking to a post-COVID time? And then if such a thing is even possible. And then just thinking about what are some of the challenges of not reinscribing normativity, thinking about disabled bodies, and thinking about how, you know, the earlier point about how we can tend to centralize human standards, but it's not just human standards, it's also standards of this sort of fictitious ideal of the human. So those are some different and disparate challenges that maybe one or all of you could speak to.
I'll just start here. I think I was the first one unmuted or something like that. I mean, in terms of not reinscribing or not sort of trying to incorporate all difference into a new sort of container, which is the constant problem of colonization. The constant problem, by the way, of even progressive politics, right? Is you have this end goal that's supposed to be all inclusive of what's best and better than what is now. That's part of the reason that I was focusing on Walter Mignolo and the Zapatistas' discussion of world among worlds and worlds among worlds. It's not that we're trying to articulate a container story that has the end goal present, but that we're trying to pay attention to as many different stories as possible and seeing what emerges from that. Not necessarily have, I mean, okay, sure, we can have some common grounds that we can agree on, like we breathe oxygen, we are mammals, and we are human beings, and gravity exists, right, for us. So, I mean, there's certain things that if you just don't agree, if you don't have to agree with them, but then that's clearly fake news and alternative facts, right? Because jump out of a window that's high up and you will see that gravity really does exist. But so there's these common grounds, but they're, it doesn't necessarily give us the end goal or the end direction, because I think that whatever these goals are, they have to emerge in the process and not just be there from the get-go, not be there saying, well, this is the container for all stories, right? No, here's one story about the whole, here's another story about the whole, and how do these worlds come together? And that's going to create a totally different story. That makes sense.
Yeah, if I could just bounce off of what you were just saying, Whitney, about gravity, you know, that's something that we could all agree on, or if we don't agree, we're sort of being a bit bodacious and goofy. But what is this thing we call gravity? And just that there are many other ways of feeling it, understanding it, than the style that most of us, you know, have been educated to. But I remember before my fancy education, I was, as a kid, just, I loved climbing up things just to jump off them. And I loved jumping and tripping. And it was like, I jump up and there's this rubber band that pulls me back to the ground. And it's like, if you want to take something kind of magical and make it disappear from people's awareness, turn it into a law. The law of gravity, and then everything just follows it automatically, and so nobody notices it anymore. But what about, for instance, that even a basic definition of that law is the mutual attraction between bodies? It's always mutual attraction between bodies, often at a distance from one another. But as soon as I hear mutual attraction, I think Eros. That sounds a lot like Eros. So is there perhaps, can we think of gravity as the erotic allurement of the earth for my body, or of my body for the earth, or of the earth for that rock that just I tossed in the air and came back down? But what if all of the little allurements or erotic attractions we have to one another are just ripples on the surface of this ocean of attraction that my body feels for the ground? And so I then, with every footfall on the earth, I'm being fed by this kind of consummate contact with my lover. And isn't not possible that our hearts are fed steadily by that kind of nourishment and that kind of attraction, which is just shut out by when we think of gravity as just this one mechanical thing.
I love that. And I've actually run with your concept of gravity as the ultimate form of love in some of the stuff that I've done. And thinking about erosophia instead of philosophia, ho, ho, ho. Such a good, fun little academic trick. But the erotics of thinking, right? And that's the gravity embodied of thinking. And I think it's a great...
I mean, in a sense, one could say that each of us in this panel extending personhood beyond the human to anything or everything, that we are by that gesture trying to open an erotic relation with everything, to open the Eros. And I think that's gorgeous. And gravity is perhaps, you know, underlies that possibility as an erotic dimension that holds the moon to the earth and the earth to the sun and the sun to the other stars. Anyway.
Well, I think that we have time for one more question, and it's from somebody who cannot speak up. So I don't want to silence the voices that are unable to speak up, because it's the middle of the night and they're with a whole family of people that they don't want to wake up. So I'm going to go ahead with this question from Walter Blankenstein. I probably said that horribly wrong, and I'm sorry. Who says I can't speak? Okay, so what do you
think? Blankenstein.
Ah, thank you. Thank you. What do you think about growing legal and political movements that advocate for granting legal personhood to the more than human, e.g. the rights of nature? Does it enforce human or Western concepts onto the non-human, or is it a positive development and a way to embed place-based internatural communication, reciprocity into political practice? Great question, since we've been talking about things that are not so practical. Anyone?
I think it's splendid. I mean, the more we can accord legal rights to rivers, to mountains, to other animals, not just to those, you know, we deem close to us, other primates and maybe some cetaceans, but to animate life generally. I think it's a fantastic and utterly necessary development, this move toward the rights of nature.
Yeah, I agree. And I also wanted to point out that sort of, you know, legal, political, and terms like that. Okay, they may be Western, but, you know, every society, and I didn't just mean human, but also other animal societies have, you know, codes of practice, you know, moral codes, codes of behavior and things like that. So, you know, we don't recognize them necessarily, now they're all savages, but basically they do. And so this is just the way currently the world operates, fortunately or unfortunately, but I definitely support it. Yeah. Of course, we include, you know, not just Westerners, we include as many peoples as possible, and I try to listen to other non-human peoples as much as we can when we are determining these things. You know, you can't just go, let's, you know, call this river a person and then just like define it so that it suits us. You know, of course we can't do that, or we can, but it wouldn't be right. But I think it's a good thing. It's a good step ahead of the current situation to give them legal rights and whatever they deserve, and we can give them.
I would agree, even though you open up a can of worms by doing it, but that's a good thing. Like what you saw in India when the river Ganga became person, or I mean, they are a god, a divinity, and has divine rights and is a person and has a legal status. But that only lasted like 4 weeks, then they took it back, because then you run into all these questions, because the god Ganga gives life, but the god Ganga also takes life. And if someone drowns in the river, or if the water is dirty, or what, who's responsible? So the person represent then the river in court are also liable for all casualties that are taken by the god, and then nobody wanted to take that responsibility, and there are all these kind of questions also in New Zealand, where the river is then represented by the elders of a certain tribe or community, and but who is it then, who represents whom? But these are all fascinating questions, and we only have to start talking about these, and we reflect in different ways on the question of riverhood, for instance, and what is divine in it, and who are the elders, can they really represent this river or not, are they spokesperson for what, and all these questions are only possible to discuss when we actually open up this possibility. So I agree as well. Yeah.
So
can I just jump?
Yes, go ahead, and then I'll say so.
So as long as we're not being cut off on the split second here, I wanted to insert a tiny question, also given that it's Earth Day, in relation to what Teja said about feeling ourselves as a herd, which in many ways I like. In fact, I pretty much loved everything that's been shared here, and especially from each of us and from Thea. Very moved. I do wonder, it's a question that has been coming to me in this time of the pandemic, when this intense empathy is opening within each of us, just feeling for others and what's happening to other smooth-skinned human sisters and brothers, suddenly finding themselves unable to draw breath, their lungs ravaged, and yet cut off by all the plastic sheets and piping from the sight, much less the touch of their children or their parents, and people living out their last hours in this. I mean, the empathy is so intense and huge. And wondering, is this because we are all a kind of herd, that because humankind is a kind of vast collective flesh or body that reverberates in each one of us? And that is, it seems to me, our common assumption, that humanity or humankind is an entity, has its existence. And I am wondering if that's true at all. It seems to me more likely that it's not, that it's an abstraction, that the idea that humanity has its own integrity, apart from all of, from our entanglement with all these other species and critters and landforms and clouds and rain. It seems rather to me that I'm unable to extend my empathy across the world to other people in New Delhi, someone suffering in a hospital in Madrid, someone, you know, hauling up fishing nets in the Indian Ocean. I mean, if we feel into the wide dispersal and expanse of this thing we call humankind, this common existence, what is its shape? I think we would notice its shape is that of a sphere, because it's the earth that gives us our space, our actual shape, because I can't reach my felt empathic solidarity to the whole of my species without the broad earth getting me there. And so it seems to me that our real common body or flesh is not humankind as an autonomous abstraction, but is this sensitive, sentient sphere we call earth. That's the biosphere itself, rippling with sensations, this vast spherical metabolism, breathing. That's us. That's our real flesh.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. That's a perfect way to move to an end here. I know that a lot of people have to go, and I really appreciate you all being here. And everyone else that already left, you can't hear me say that, but I appreciate you too. Thanks so much to all of our panelists. And we will have other events online coming up soon. So hopefully we'll see you all again. Is that, Kaku, did you have anything you want to add?
No, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much.
Cheers. David has one. David, you offer to wrap this whole thing up with a poem?
Oh, only if there is.
I think that would be very nice
to
end this day.
A poem for Earth Day. This is not a poem by me. I'm thinking of a poem by the most animistic. I mean, we've been discussing very, very animistic notions through the last couple of hours. The most animistic poet working in the English language, I feel, was alive and kicking at the end of the 19th century. His name is Gerard Manley Hopkins. And he was a very religious man, a Jesuit priest, but he was also outrageously wondrous in his astonishment at this world and its ways, but he worked with language in a way he was interested in the feels of terms, the rhythm, the texture of words, even more than the dictionary meanings. So I'll just offer this as an ending. One of his poems, it's called, if I'm remembering right, it's about a stream called Inversnaid. And I'll offer that up. He was posted to Glasgow, Scotland, as a priest and was listening in the local dialects for words that tasted good on his tongue. And one of them was the dialect word for a stream. And the word was burn. And so this is his poem, Inversnaid. This darksome burn, horseback brown, his roll rock high road roaring down, in coop and in comb, the fleece of his foam, flutes and low to the lake falls home. A windpuff bonnet of fawn froth turns and twindles over the broth of a pool so pitch black, fell frowning, it rounds and rounds despair to drowning. Degged with dew, dappled with dew, are the groins of the braes that the brook treads through. Wiry heath packs, flitches of fern, and the bead bonny ash that sits o'er the burn. What would the world be, once bereft of wet and of wilderness? Let them be left, oh, let them be left, wildness and wet. Long live the weeds and the wilderness yet. Happy Earth Day, everybody.
Thank you so much. That was delightful. Thank you, everyone. Happy Earth Day. Cheers. Thank you.